唱歌，我就把
that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Why should the black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And when, and naturally, it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate your origin and not end up hating yourself. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. And you show me one of these people over here who have been thoroughly brainwashed, who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one that has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a negative attitude toward yourself, a positive attitude toward yourself, and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your attitude, that your understanding of an attitude toward Africa becomes positive, you'll find that your understanding of and your attitude toward yourself will also become positive. And this is what the white man knows. So they very skillfully made you and me hate our African identity, our African characteristics. And you know yourself that we have been a people who hated our African characteristics. We hated our hair. We hated the shape of our nose. We wanted one of those long dog-like noses, you know. Yeah. We hated the color of our skin. Hated the blood of Africa that was in our veins. And in hating our features and our skin and our blood, why, we had to end up hating ourselves. And we hated ourselves. Our color became to us a chain. We felt that it was holding us back. Our color became to us like a prison, which we felt was keeping us confined, not letting us go this way or that way. And we felt that all of these restrictions were based solely upon our color, and the psychological reaction to that would have to be that as long as we felt imprisoned or chained or trapped by black skin, black features, and black blood, that skin and those features and that blood that was holding us back automatically had to become hateful to us. And it became hateful to us. It made us feel inferior. It made us feel inadequate. It made us feel helpless. And when we fell victim to this feeling of inadequacy or inferiority or helplessness, we turned to somebody else to show us the way. We didn't have confidence in another black man to show us the way, or black people to show us the way. In those days, we didn't. We didn't think a black man could do anything but play some horn, you know, some sound, and make you happy with some songs, and in that way. In serious things, where our food, clothing, and shelter was concerned, and our education was concerned, we turned to the man. We never thought in terms of bringing these things into existence for ourselves. We never thought in terms of doing things for ourselves, because we felt helpless. And what made us feel helpless was our hatred for ourselves. One of the things that made the black Muslim movement grow was its emphasis upon things African. This was the secret to the growth of the black Muslim movement. African blood, African origin, African culture, African ties. And you'd be surprised. We discovered that deep within the subconscious of the black man in this country, he's still more African than he is American. He thinks that he's more American than African because the man is jiving him and the man is brainwashing him every day, telling him, you're an American. Man, how could you think you're an American and you have never had any kind of American treat over here? You have never, never. 10 men can be sitting at a table eating, you know, dining. And I can come and sit down where they're dining. They're dining. I got a plate in front of me, but nothing is on it. Because all of us are sitting at the same table, are all of us diners? I'm not a diner until you let me dine. Then I become a diner. Just being at the table with others who are dining doesn't make me a diner. And this is what you got to get in your head here in this country. Just because you're in this country doesn't make you an American. And no, you got to go farther than that before you can become an American. You got to enjoy the fruits of Americanism. And you haven't enjoyed those fruits. You've enjoyed the thorns. You've enjoyed the thistles, but you have not enjoyed the fruits. No, sir. So I point these things out, brothers and sisters, so that you and I will know the importance in 1965 of being in complete unity with each other, harmony with each other, and not letting the man maneuver us into fighting one another. I say that again that I'm not a racist. I don't believe in any form of segregation or anything like that. I'm for the brotherhood of everybody, but I don't believe in forcing brotherhood upon people who don't want it. As long as we practice brotherhood among ourselves, and then others who want to practice brotherhood with us, we practice it with them also, we're for that. But I don't think that we should run around trying to love somebody who doesn't love us. Thank you.
Hotep, my sisters and brothers, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. It is such an honor to be with you here this evening. We are here in our studios in Lithonia, Georgia. where we have a rainy evening. But nevertheless, it's still wonderful and great, and we're enjoying it, and I hope where you are, it's just as pleasant as well. So happy to be able to open up with the words of our great ancestor, El-Hajj Malik Shabazz, formerly known as Malcolm X. And we are here today, tonight, this evening, to talk about Mother Africa. And the title of our program was, Is Africa Calling You Home? Is Africa Calling You Home? And many of our brothers and sisters have said, yes, Africa is calling me home. So I thought maybe tonight we would talk a little bit about the history of previous movements who also heard that call and who knew that they wanted to expatriate back home. And we want to see what they did, what were their successes, what were their plans of action, how did they do, what were their failures. And in doing that, we can also look at ourselves, those who wish to also make that journey home. What are some of the particulars that we need to look at? And I thought maybe it would be a good idea to do it in a think tank session. This is the Black Reality Think Tank, and just for informational wise, when you pull together a think tank, what you're doing is you're pulling together individuals who first of all have a common interest, who bring to the table a particular specificity that can be used to talk about the subject at hand. Usually in the more formal big money think tanks, they'll bring in people like economists, political scientists, historians, anthropologists, and different people of those genres, and they'll come together and talk about their disciplines and how to bring them together to formulate a plan of action to put into work. And so I think that's one of the things that we have to do. I mean, it has been done in the past. There have been people like Dr. Nathan Hare who pulled together a think tank to talk about that. People like Randall Robertson who pulled together an organization called TransAfrica, which was used as well as a way to talk about the trip to home, to Africa, if necessary, if possible, and what we're looking at, at some of the specifics and particulars. And so tonight we're going to talk about that. I see I have one of my guests on who I definitely am planning to call, Dr. Bruce Bridges. He is the author of a book called Recapturing the African Mind, and he has written extensively on the Pan-African expatriation movements. And so we want to talk a little bit about that, get his expertise in terms of that history, as well as others of you here who can add to that conversation as well. And we want to do it in a think tank perspective. And that way we can maybe hopefully pull some things together and be able to offer a plan of action. Last week we had a wonderful dynamic conversation with a young lady out of Dallas, Texas, whose name is Jamie Lachey. I think her, as they call it, her government name is Jamie Jenkins, but she was an educator and an educational consultant, and we talked about the steps necessary to start what we call Saturday schools, but basically they are community schools run by the community, funded by the community, that don't necessarily embrace the Board of Education. That was a dynamic conversation. And you can get that on our archive by going to the timeforawakening.com webpage. It's there. Please listen to that. Interesting conversation, wonderful suggestions that were made by not only just Ms. Lachey, but many people in our audience. We had a very strong panel of individuals that talked about that. And so I would suggest that you go back and look at that. So tonight we're going to talk about Mother Africa, and we're going to be getting to that task very soon. One of the things that I thought I would like to add to my program occasionally, not necessarily every week, but occasionally, you know, obviously just like so many of you, you know, you read a lot of papers and magazines and news items, and I try to take less from social media, and I look more at mainline items and articles I look at black newspapers, obviously. I look at business newspapers, because the business newspapers sometimes tell you, you know, how the power thinking is thinking. And also look at new books that are coming out and things that I think will be of interest. So I want to share a couple of things with you today before we get into our discussion. And obviously, as always, I want to do our ancestral profile. We cannot begin a program without first considering our ancestors, because we always stand on their shoulders, and without them, we would not be where we are. And one of the things that I repeat every week is the words of the mighty, mighty Fannie Lou Hamer. And she said, we must always praise the bridges that brought us over. So, do that. Let's first of all start off by simply talking about our ancestors. And I've got a bad sister that I want to talk about today. And she's tough, man. This is a tough, all of our ancestors are tough sisters, but this was a very unique individual. I had read the book by Dr. Mary Frances Berry that she wrote about this particular individual, and I had shelved that years ago. And the other day when I was looking through some things, I ran across it. I said, aha, here we go. This is what I need to talk about. And the sister that I'm going to discuss as our ancestral profile today, her name is Callie, C-A-L-L-I-E, House. H-O-U-S-E, Callie House. Callie House was born in 1861, and she transitioned to the ancestral world in 1928. Now, check out what this sister did. She was the leader of an organization that she and a group of other individuals started called the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief. Let me pause just a second. I need to. There's a couple of callers on, and I just kind of need to. Okay, I'm sorry about that. You know, there were background noise, and so sometimes I need to just quiet that for a second. So again, she started an organization. She and another group of individuals started an organization called the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association. I'll repeat that. It was called the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association. It was one of the first organizations in America to campaign for reparations for slavery in the United States. Miss Callie House, born 1861, and she was born in captivity. She was born in Rutherford County, which is Nashville, Tennessee. And at 22 years of age, she married a man by the name of William House. They had six children, five of which survived, and also her husband transitioned. And so therefore, she was left to support the family alone. And she did so by being a washerwoman. House met a man who understood some of the goals and objectives that she had, and the two of them, his name was Isaiah Dickerson. So Miss Callie House and Isaiah Dickerson traveled to many ex-slave states to gather support for the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association, which is called MRBNPA. They visited black churches, one of the few places that they could go where obviously whites would not interrupt them, and where they could organize in some sort of peace. The NRBNPA was chartered on August the 7th, 1897. They actually did get a charter from the state. And the charter was the goal of providing compensation to ex-slaves to give mutual aid and also burial costs. And at its peak, the organization claimed membership in the hundreds of thousands, the hundreds of thousands. Now, despite a lack of evidence, the Federal Post Office Department accused them of organizing this reparations movement and was defrauding their members. So in 1889, the MRB and PA was forbidden to send mail or cash money orders. The Department of Justice opened an investigation on them, and in 1901, Dickerson was found guilty of swindling. But the conviction was overturned, and upon Dickerson's death in 1909, House became the leader of the NRB and PA. And despite interference with males, the NRPB struggled on under her leadership. They were able to make many payments. They were able to provide money for burial. There were certain rules and regulations that were required for ex-slave members to receive these funds. But a lot of the money came from missionary societies and a lot of white abolitionists and those who were sympathetic and supportive of the abolitionist movement as well as the reparations movement. And I don't know exactly the dollar amount that they collected over the years, but if you are very interested in her and would like to know more about her, there is a book that was written by Mary Frances Berry, who is a historian and was at one time the head of the Civil Rights Commission for the federal government. It's called My Face is Black is True. My Face is Black is True. Callie House and the Struggle of Ex-Slave Reparations. I'll repeat it once more. Her name is, the author is Mary Frances Berry, B-E-R-R-Y. The name of the book is My Face is Black is True. Callie House and the Struggle for Ex-Slave Reparations. It was published in 2005 by Alfred A. Knopf. I had the opportunity to hear Dr. Berry do a presentation on her at an annual meeting of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, which is founded by Dr. Carter G. Woodson in Charleston, South Carolina, when it was held in Charleston. And so for those of you who might be interested in this powerful sister, I do say I would suggest that you take a look at this book. Okay, now what I'd like to also do is there's an activity that I would like to just mention to our listening audience. I know all of you are very astute, strong historians, very powerfully into your culture, and so this might be of interest to you. On June the 2nd, there is going to be the Georgia Sea Island Festival. This is the Gullah Island Festival that's held annually in Georgia. It's called the Georgia Sea Island Festival, and it's celebrating the African-American musical traditions. There'll be crafts and food of the coastal barrier islands. And the annual Georgia Sea Island Festival takes place, as I said, on June the 2nd from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Gascoigne Bluff Park, G-A-S-C-O-I-G-N-E, Bluff Park in St. Simons Island. And it says that when you come, expect to eat samples, smoked mullet, fried fish, sweet potato pone, and homemade ice cream. It said, oh, you'll also see demonstrations of traditional Gullah Geechee crafts, and you will be musicians, a lot of original Gullah music. And there is a phone number for those who might be interested in going. It's area code 912-634-0330. I repeat, area code 912-634-0330. And that's the Georgia Sea Island Festival. And that's a wonderful activity. And if you get a chance to go, you get a chance to buy some of those rice baskets. They hand-woven baskets that the women make and sell all kinds of different designs. Great stuff. And a lot of other things as well, too. I remember going one year, and a lady gave me some pure African oil that I could use. She said, when the arthritis start hitting you, she said, just rub that on there a little bit. And I've done that. I wish I could go back and get some more of that. But you get those kinds of things. It's that kind of an environment, this kind of activity, real African family tradition. So I thought maybe I wanted to make sure I passed that on to you so that you could see and hear as well. And then the last item that I wanted to kind of talk about that I ran across, and it kind of embraces a lot of what we've been saying here on this program and on some of the other programs on Time for Awakening, Brother Elliott's program, Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, African Perspectives, Time for Awakening. And it's about the preparation of what we see that's going on in our society today that lets us as African people know we have got to wake up and see what's happening to us. This is an article that was in Sunday's Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and it was written by a brother that I kind of like the stuff he does. His name is Leonard Pitts, Jr., and he writes for the Miami Herald. And he's an editorial writer, and this is a magnificent story. I mean, it's the historical story I have heard before, but very clearly he is making a point by recapturing this story again based on a lot of the things that are currently happening now. So I'm going to read this very briefly. It won't take long. And he starts off by saying, fair warning, this story will disgust you. But this week, Saturday, to be exact, marks 100 years since a singular act of barbarism in tiny Valdosta, Georgia. And the tale of what happened there demands to be recalled. It began when someone killed Hampton Smith, a white plantation owner. Suspicion fell on Sidney Johnson, an African-American worker said to have had a wage dispute with Smith. A vengeful white mob, unable to find Johnson, killed other black people instead, including a man named Hayes Turner. His wife, Hayes Turner's wife, was outraged beyond self-preservation. She loudly vowed to swear out a warrant against the murderers. So the next day, they came to see her. Mary Turner was maybe 20 years old. She was 8 months pregnant. They strung her up by her ankles in a tree. They doused her with gasoline and motor oil. They set her afire. But that wasn't the worst of what they did. The NAACP official, Walter White, a pale African-American man with blonde hair and blue eyes, whose appearance allowed him to interview lynch mobs members, left a chilling account in his 1929 book called Rope and Faggot, a biography of Judge Lynch. Now note, he says, though, now used primarily as an anti-gay slur, faggot also means a bundle of sticks. So wrote White. He said, mocking ribald laughter from her tormentors, answering the helpless woman's screams of pain and terror. Mister, you ought to have heard the rigor wench howl. You should have heard that nigger wench howl, a member of the mob boasted to White a few days later. The clothes having burnt from her crispy, toasted body, in which, unfortunately, life still lingered. A man stepped towards the woman and with his knife ripped open her abdomen in a crude, serious operation, and out tumbled the prematurely born child. Two feeble cries it gave and received for its answer the heel of a stalwart man as life was ground out of this tiny form. The baby died without a name. History does not even record its gender. The mob buried it with its mother in a shallow grave. As a headstone, they stuck an empty whiskey bottle in the ground with a half-smoked cigar poking up out of the neck. I told you you'd be disgusted. And maybe you're wondering why I felt the need to share such a grisly tale. Call it a reminder. In a time when we see tribal hatreds rising with renowned vigor all over the world, a time when fascism is on the march in Charlottesville, Virginia, and on the ballot in Slovakia, and on the ballot in Georgia, a time when neo-Nazis spread terror from Athens, Greece, to Charleston, South Carolina, a time when seven police cars and a helicopter are deployed because a white woman sees three black people checking out an Airbnb, bed and breakfast, a time when former presidential counselor Stephen Bannon advises the far right to wear accusations of racism as a badge of honor. In such a time, it is useful, indeed critical, to be reminded that we've seen this movie many times before, and we already know how it ends, what inevitably happens when some of us declare others of us less human than the rest of us. It is a lesson we've been taught too many times, a lesson learned in the blood-stained machetes of Rwanda and screams rising over the streets of Nanking, in flakes of black ash swirling from a crematorium chimney in Poland, in the tear gas lungs of a dead baby in Gaza, in the broken body of a baby crushed into the Georgia mud 100 years ago. It is a lesson we too often swaddle in euphemism and myth, so the harsh truth of it cannot be repeated often enough. You hated that story, yes, but you won't soon forget it. It will trouble you for a long time. Maybe that's not the worst thing in the world. Leonard Pitts, Jr. And that was in the Sunday Atlanta Journal-Constitution in the editorial page. So from time to time, I will share with you articles that I encounter of this nature and talk a little bit about them and just share it with you, our audience. So tonight, we are going to talk about Africa. And we are launched to do so. And one of the whys to this discussion is that we are often hear now lately that because of so many of the devastating things that African people are experiencing in this country and how it has heightened a lot, that one of the things that we need to do is we try to see if there's a way to solve these problems or do anything is that it looks hopeless. And so maybe we need to look back at Africa. Well, this won't be the first time, and that's really the purpose of this program. There have been many, 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 many attempts to look back at Africa as a way of going home. It started actually early in the late 1600s. It actually started then, but it had a strange bedfellow to it. So I want to, first of all, start off by just historically laying the framework for what we know as colonization movements, back to Africa movements. And there have been several types over history. There have been the big structured types where there's a lot of people involved and a lot of organization. And then there have been some clandestine movements where people were working behind the scenes attempting to do this. And then there have been some actually perpetrated by slave owners. They were organizing back to Africa movements. And then obviously the governments back to African colonization movements. So obviously when we look at the different attempts, we have to determine who's involved here and who's behind some of that. And the early 1600 ones were obviously based on missionary societies. A lot of the back to Africa movements came out of the work of missionaries. And it was involved in terms of going back, helping the poor Africans who don't know how to do for themselves, according to their logic. And let's go back and help them, give them Jesus, give them the Bible, give them food, do this, do that. You know, those kinds of philosophies were behind some of those early missionary efforts. And then let's take some of the poor Africans here and take them back home, pick them back, let them get started, and so forth and so on. And then there were those that were more radical in nature, where we were going to go back and find land and harvest and create new homes for ourselves and do some of those kinds of things. And so, as I said, there were different steps. So there are a couple of individuals that I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to bring on Dr. Bridges, who's going to help me do that because he knows some of these as well. But I just want to start off, first of all, mentioning some of those early writers and even the late writers who told us about Africa, who said, you know, that Africa was ready for our people to come home. you know, because as the Malcolm said in the opening remarks, he said that we've always had this painted picture of the ugliness of Malcolm. It was lions and elephants and all kind of crazy stories that was there. They even passed it among themselves that there was a big round hole in the middle of Africa, and if you went into that dark hole, you would fall in. And we've seen the literature. There's a book written by this white racist writer. It's called The Heart of Darkness. And he wrote another book called The Nigger of Narcissus. And these were books that were used as textbooks in schools, and they talked about Africa. We've seen what National Geographic used to do out of the 50s and 40s, and they put these pictures of the African nations with plates in their lips and would put that in there and not explain exactly that these were part of very sacred rituals. And so we've had a negative image of that. And so those of us who were in the Americas, who were coming out of captivity, definitely did not want to look at Africa as any kind of possibility. So there needed to be a picture that could be painted that would tell a different story. And that's where some of our great historians and some of our early writers come into play, because they began to provide us with a different perspective of what Joseph Conrad was his name that wrote the book, The Heart of Darkness and The Nigger of Narcissus. Those are books that were negative in a lot of what they said and did. And so his idea was to present something. There was other writers. And one of the first writers that gives us a different perspective of Africa was an African himself. He was an African captive. He was a prince. His name was Gustavus Vassa. And Gustavus Vassa, Equiano Oladao was his African name, and he eventually chose this Gustavus Vassa, which was a Portuguese name. He was educated, and he was able to write extensively, and he wrote his narratives. Not only did he write about Africa itself, but he wrote about what it was like in captivity. And so we were able to get a real picture and image of the system of chattel slavery from Gustavus Vassa, Oladao Equiano as well. That's what we want to refer to him here as Oladao Equiano, because that is his African name. And then there was other writers, and there was a group of young brothers out of Liberia, and they were called the Sons of Africa. This was one of the first movements to organize. Now, they were Britons. They had been in captivity, lived in Britain, but they remembered the African system, and they were called Sons of Africa. And they had been to the Americas, been back to Africa, and so they contributed very heavily. So I'm really just going to give you the names, and I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail, because what I'd like for you to do is research these things yourself. But the Sons of Africa are operating in around the 1700s as well, the late 1700s. But they do also provide an image of a different Africa, as well as the energy to look at the possibility of returning. And then one of my heroes that was obviously very involved in the Back to Africa movement as an individual ground root movement was Prince Hall, who was the founder of the Prince Hall Mason. Prince Hall was very active in Massachusetts and got together with the government, and they organized the Back to Africa. But what they did, though, is they attempted to try to get the Boston or the Massachusetts government to agree to it. And obviously they would not agree because, you know, one of the oppositions to that from Europeans was the fact that you were taking away the labor force. And so, but Prince Hall, nevertheless, he and a group of men got together and attempted to organize and purchase a ship and go back to Africa to be where they lived. Also, the AMEs, the African Methodist Episcopal System, also was going to organize a effort. That was one of Richard Allen and Absalom Jones. Sale on Poor. All of them were involved in the idea of going back home. You know, now it had to be worked out, however, they painted the groundwork that this was possible. And then there is another who came in through the missionary system, but he came in as a revolutionary, and he today is celebrated very heavily by the Baptists. His name was Lot Carey, L-O-T-T-C-A-R-E-Y. A lot of you who may be Baptists, you probably know or have heard of the Lot Carey Convention. Lot Carey was an African who went to Liberia, and he actually became the governor of Liberia for a while. And but his whole idea was that we need to go back home, and we can do this, and we can create a system that can make it possible. And Lot Carey had a couple of gentlemen that were working with him. One was a man named Elijah Johnson. Elijah Johnson, and you can obviously look up all of these brothers and see what they were doing and get a more detailed picture of their efforts. And then another one was a man named Clinton Caldwell Boone. Clinton Caldwell Boone, B-O-O-N-E. Now, what's unique about him is he went into the Congo. Now, again, it's missionary stuff. But he went into the Congo to work in the missionary system and to look at the possibility of negotiating with the chiefs of the villages space and opportunity for Africans to return home. And he was a physician. And he went in to attempt to try to convince a lot of the chiefs. Because one of the things that we find in these early movements where folk like Lot Carey, Clinton Boone, and some of the others that were actually going down into Liberia, into Africa, trying to pave a way, is that that was resistance from Africa in some ways. And the reasoning is basically just logical. They saw it, the possibility of threats and in terms of space and land, and they saw it as a what is it that you're going to do here? Are we going to be moved out? Are you going to take our land from us? Those kinds of things. Because one of the problems is that they were missionaries and they were part of white organizations and white structures. So one of the things we found in that history is rebellion. And in some of the cases, the rebellion was bloody. There was a massacre that occurred in a place called Port Crescent. Port Crescent, C-R-E-S-S-O-N. Port Crescent. And this was a massacre that took place because the villagers were working with slave traders. And they were taking a lot of their war captives and selling them to slave traders. And so the community of the Africans that had moved there, it was about 300 to 500 Africans that had moved to this area in Liberia. And so the slave traders, they had to also watch out for them taking them captive and selling them back into slavery. But the problem with the African chief that was in charge of this area, who had this area, the slave traders told him that they were going to have to cut off their business ties with him. Because of the fact that they didn't want to come into the U.S. System, the government, the colonization system, and so they didn't want a conflict with that. So they were going to back away and not trade with them and go find somebody else to trade with. Well, this angered the chief. His name was King Joe. King Joe. And he was in charge of a group called the Bassa people, B-A-S-S-A, the Bassa people. And King Joe took a group of his men and went into the colonization movement and killed about 100 of them and told them that they were going to have to leave and leave right then. And they warred with them. The people of the community who were a part of the repatriation community could not fight back because they didn't have weapons. But King Joe and his men, based on their relationship with the slave traders, had guns and were able to successfully kill them. However, Lot Carey and a group of missionaries from the system were able to go in with a military force, and they struck a deal with King Joe where, number one, he would stop trading with the slave traders, and that he would also give compensation back, you know, to those that were involved. So this was an example of some of the resistance to a lot of that. And getting some of the later African Americans to get involved with this after some of that was difficult. For instance, Frederick Douglass refused to acknowledge Africa as a potential for going back as a solution to our problem. Douglass was very hardcore about that. As a matter of fact, there's an article that was written in a journal by Daniel Kilbride. Daniel Kilbride, and the name of the article is "What Did Africa Mean to Frederick Douglass?" And basically, it spells out that he was in opposition to using that as a solution. At one point, he had been asked to serve as an ambassador to one of the African countries. He refused to do that. He did not want anything to do with Africa. And a lot of that came out of, first of all, he felt, because it was dealing with some of those missionaries, abolitionists that were not real slave traders who were just trying to get blacks out of the country, and some of those kinds of ideas as well. That is kind of a part of the story of what we are looking at, and when we look about some of those early, and there's a lot more to it as well, because there are some individuals that do emerge that were trying very hard to open up the doors and open up those floodgates to make that possible. But a lot of the negative thoughts that were coming from Africa, from the British, a lot of this was the British, the missionary system, you know, some of its flaws that were there. And then eventually, as you know, in 1807, the British abolished the slave trade, meaning that they abolished being able to go to Africa and bring back people, but that didn't stop them. They kept doing it anyway. But still, it was abolished. And then there was a Slave Trade Act in 1788 that was also designed to take away some of the cruelty of the slave trade, if you can say that. That's like an oxymoron. But anyway, it was designed to regulate how many Africans could be put on the ship at one time, because you know a lot of those ships were packed. 300-400 people, and the ships were only designed to hold 200. But these are things that the Lot Carey was involved in that, and some of the others were involved in trying to force some changes legislatively. Then there were some serious, ugly massacres that occurred. There's one called the Zong, Z-O-N-G massacre. This was where the ship was packed so tight, and with so many people that they ran out of water, and it was not enough water to give the slaves. And this was based on an insurance issue, because the ship was insured, and so people were dying. And so in order for them to be able to claim the death of the people on board, it had to be made to look like it was just done naturally. So what they did is they threw people overboard. And shot and killed them, and made it look like they died naturally, you know, and it wasn't their fault. But these are just some of those ugly, ugly things. There's one last resource that I want to give any of our audience that's interested in getting this detailed history of the early Pan-African, and I use Pan-African because a lot of the work of people like Lot Carey and a lot of the work of Prince Hall was based on a love and a dedication of the continent. And it was not based on any economic stuff. It wasn't based on they just following white folks' steps. They did have their own plan. And so they were some of the early Pan-Africanists. But there's a book by Hakim, H-A-K-I-M, Adi, A-D-I, and Marika Sherwood, M-A-R-I-K-A, Sherwood. And the name of the book is Pan-African History, Political Figures from Africa and the diaspora since 1787. I'll re-say it again. It's Hakeem Adi, A-D-I, and Marika Sherwood, S-H-E-R-W-O-O-D. The name of the book is Pan-African History, Political Figures from Africa and the Diaspora since 1787. And so a lot of the information that I've given to you in talking today comes from that book. She goes into a much more detailed discussion about the whole Pan-African movement and idea, but nevertheless, it carries us. And then we move into obviously the 20th century. One of the first individuals to launch to the first internet was Paul Cuffey. We know Cuffey's initial that he attempted to do, but he was blocked because of the embargo that was placed, the War of 1812. There was an embargo where you could not travel the ocean because of the conflict between America and the British. And so Cuffey had attempted to pull together a group of people. He did do one trip, but he attempted to do the second trip. He could not do so simply because of the fact that it was, you know, the embargo took place. So that was a very deep kind of history as well. And then John Rushworm, who started the first black newspaper, Freedom Journal. He was involved in the Pan-African struggle and the Back to Africa movement as well. As a matter of fact, John Rushworm became the governor of what's called Merlin, and that's in Merlin, Liberia. And he was the governor of that, and he was involved very heavily in that. And there were some other individuals like John Rushworm that was involved in that. But another part is that one of the best sources of looking at this African history is coming from two very powerful scholars of the 20th century who were writing out of Howard University. One of them is Dr. William Leo Hansberry, and the other was Joseph Harris. They have provided us with an in-depth knowledge of Africa, African kingdoms, African systems of politics and economics that would have made it ripe for a repatriation movement. But as we're going to talk about in the next few minutes, it all has to be done skillfully, though. It cannot just be haphazard. A bunch of people get on the boat and say, "We're going back to Africa. You get off the boat. I'm here." No. You got to do some negotiating way ahead of time. And we want to talk about that and see how some of our folk have done and how they have seen that. So with that, I'm going to open up the lines. I think I know where you are, Dr. Bridges. And there's no way for me to kind of tell because I have a couple of 919 numbers on here. Let's see. Is this you, Dr. Bridges, here?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, all right. I got you. Very good. You're on there.
Okay. And we want to get others a chance, too. But you've been talking about some good stuff. You're doing some good teaching there, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you, my good brother. Thank you. I know you're going to add right into that. Why don't you start off by first telling us what you know about the early Pan-African Back to Africa movement stuff?
Well, one thing about it is, to take it to the white side for a minute, you know, Abraham Lincoln was for getting Africans out of America and to go back to Africa.
Right.
He said that we were in their way and that we're a problem to them, and we need to go on back to Africa. And he said, if not Africa, maybe we should send some of you down to Mexico and to the Honduras and some of the to Central America. So there were several whites who were also for getting blacks out of America into Africa for different reasons, of course. But there were whites who were for going back to Africa. You see, and but there were different reasons, of course, that they were doing that. So early on, Lincoln was one of them doing before the actual Emancipation Proclamation was signed. He talked about it, and as you said quite well, you can read that when you read and study the history of Abraham Lincoln and what he really was about. They really wanted us out of this country, but for different reasons, you see. So you're quite right on that on that point.
Right. Right. Exactly. And so you're right. There was a governmental, and pre-Lincoln, Monroe was also.
That's right. Monroe was too. President Monroe.
President Monroe, right. As a matter of fact, the capital was Monrovia, which was named after him. Can you tell me a little
right.
bit about
that? That's right. When Liberia was settled, right, in the 1800s, right. Liberia was settled. Liberia come from the word liberation because many of the ex-slaves from America who went back to Africa named the capital Monrovia after James Monroe. And the country itself, Liberia, which already existed, was called Liberia, meaning liberation. And since you mentioned that, too, there's always been some conflicts and contrast between Africans in the continental African, we'll call them, and the ones coming to America. And since you mentioned Liberia, this is really the root of a lot of problems that were found in Liberia in the 80s when Samuel Doe was there and when Tubman and Talbot Tubman were there. The root of a lot of problems and a lot of strife in Liberia, when you study Liberia, you find that Liberia, somewhat similar, not based on color, but similar to class, had a caste or class system pretty much like India,
right.
In that it was based upon who you were, because Africans, and this is a problem that we as people have to address, we feel that if we are around white people, somehow it makes us better.
Mm-hmm.
So the slaves who expatriated or left America and went to Liberia, they felt that they were better than the Africans on the African continent because they had been around the slave master over here in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Mississippi, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that they were better. And so really a source of a lot of the conflict and those wars that took place over several years and the coup d'etats that took place in Liberia was based upon blacks who had been, and I use the term, blacks who had been infected by the illness of these white people in this country, and they took it back to Africa with them, and they thought they were better than the African brothers and sisters,
right.
You see. And so, and it's all dealing with the whole idea that white is better, and the closer you can get to white and being like white, then the better off you are.
Right.
And so since you mentioned Liberia, that's why I wanted to just chime in on
that. That's good, because Liberia was
that.
The key. Now, Ghana also was a part of some of the expatriation system. I mean, even in the early years, prior to Nkrumah, Ghana was involved. There were some things I ran across about them. But you're right. Most of it was Liberia.
That was the problem when you go back to Charles Taylor, who is in jail right now somewhere up where Switzerland or somewhere. They got him in jail for war crimes against Sierra Leone and Samuel Doe.
Right.
And it was based upon a class system in Liberia about thinking that blacks who came there, went there from this country, were better than the Africans who were already there. Now, one time in several years of the history of Liberia, you find that during the time of Talbot, it was a very stable government. As a matter of fact, I was reading the biography of Nina Simone, and she talked about how she would always like to go over to Monrovia, and she hung out there and used to club and party there at a club called the Maze. And a lot of Africans from America would go to Liberia, and Liberia had a stable government. But
okay.
All the while that stability was going on, there was an undercurrent of conflict in Liberia based upon the fact that Africans from this country had, because we're all Africans, but Africans from this country had gone back to Africa and had felt that they were superior to the Africans who were already there. And that's why a lot of those coups took place in Liberia.
Right. Now,
not color, not so much color, which I want to make clear, but really it was based upon class. I'm
right.
better than you. I'm better than you because I went to Duke University and you went to NCCU.
Right.
I'm better than you because I joined the white fraternity and you joined Omega Psi Phi.
Yeah, just like it is here in the States, in the same way. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Right.
Let me ask you, what did you know about, now, one of the things that I think that has to be brought into our discussion as we kind of think tank this whole idea of expatriation back into Africa, is that there is some resistance from the Africans. Now, I talked about earlier that Bassa Nation that went in there and fought King Joe. His name was King Joe. And actually, you know what the unique thing about the Bassa people is, actually they were commissions. They were, their heritage traces back to Kemet. But they didn't want they didn't want them to come into their land because they said it was going to be disruptive, and they went in there and killed them. What did you know about the resistance from the Africans about the movement?
I agree with you 100%. And see, that's always been the problem with Africans, this tribalism, even among ourselves, and we have to learn to accept the truth about ourselves. We on this soil somehow are indifferent towards the Africans, but by the same token, Africans did not, from the continental Africans, oftentimes did not want us. Let me give you a good example. Okay. I went to Zimbabwe when President Robert Mugabe was in power, and I sat with a group of people from this country who were trying to talk to Mugabe when he was younger and, you know, in, of sound mind and doing some real good things. But we were trying to talk to Mugabe about having dual citizenship, becoming citizens of a country like Zimbabwe. But Mugabe was not for that. Somehow, or he was not for it at all. And somehow, the only person who really was for that, and I wouldn't say only person, but one person who was really for that was Kwame Nkrumah. Nkrumah made, he opened Africa up to Africans, those at home and abroad. But you see, when you have not been influenced by the teachings of Marcus Garvey and have not studied over here and really don't understand that we're one people, then you don't get that perspective. And Mugabe, with all his education, his British education, you know, he was Catholic. Robert Gabriel, after the Gabriel going to blow your horn in the Bible, he still realized that he was a citizen of Zimbabwe, but he had not embraced the whole idea of Pan-Africanism as had Nkrumah. And Nkrumah embraced it because he sat down in those study groups with Ben and Clark and John G. Jackson and Hubert Harrison in New York and Philadelphia. And he learned that, and he began to see that. But most Africans are very much to themselves and very much, you know, we're African, you're Black American, but we're still different people, you see. And so until we can get back to that kind of mentality that Nkrumah had, we'll never quite understand it. And he, like I said, over and above most others, was for, you know, dual citizenship and having citizenship. And like for example, as you know, Jews in this country can get citizenship in Israel, but we can't get citizenship in an African country, you see. So it's really a mentality, and I'll never forget that Mugabe, he was not for that. And a lot of that also comes from thinking of the Europeans in terms of trying to divide us one against the other. That will make us think that there's a lot of difference between an African in Zimbabwe and an African in Ghana. And one way you can see this, if you ever meet some brothers and sisters from the continent, if you find, for example, they're from the Congo, they will know about the history of the Congolese people and King Leopold and all that. But they will know, but they'll know very little about anything over and beyond their country. The borders that Europeans have drawn geographically as well as mentally among Africans is tremendous. For example, you can go to Ghana and people in Ghana will know very little about people in Namibia, for example. You know, they were basically restricted to their own little tribal region or part of Africa, and is partitioned by Europeans geographically. They also partitioned us mentally, and so therefore we see more differences than we see similarities. But all that was for the fact that they could continue to rule us by making us be divided. Oh, he's from Ghana, I'm from Ethiopia, I'm from Zimbabwe, and he's from Libya, or she's from Kemet or Egypt, and he's from Angola. You see, but and this is why Nkrumah was so important to the struggle of African people. But his knowledge basically came from his own study too, but first of all, being initiated in this country and reading the works of Marcus Garvey.
Yeah, and you're right. And you know, if you really do a careful study of Garver's idea about going back to Africa, a lot of that wasn't so logistical based on his own understanding that there was going to be resistance. And it was mainly, first of all, just an idea to get people's minds to thinking back about Africa. But the actual genuine steps of process of going back, when you carefully read what he is saying there, it's going to take some work, you know, because like you said, Nkrumah, he actually went so far as to issue a document called the Right of Abode.
That's exactly right.
You remember the Right of Abode?
Yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh.
And he's the only one kind of really did that. Nobody else did that.
And interesting enough, Bill, Garvey often talked about Africa, the greatness of Africa, and going back to Africa.
Right.
But Garvey himself, as you well know, never set foot on the soil of Africa.
That's right.
But his mind was in Africa. His mind was in Africa. But his adversary, who was against Africa at first until he rose to the position in his thinking that Garvey was already holding, Du Bois, who was against Africa at first, being with the white folk and thinking he was French from up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and wearing white gloves and canes and that kind of thing, and French suits and French ties, W.B. Du Bois and all that. He was not thinking Africa at first, but eventually Garvey never set foot in Africa, but Du Bois died in Africa at about 98 years of age,
right,
working on the Encyclopedia of Africana.
That's right.
You're right.
And you know, I found some. I found some material.
So Africa really is. I'm gonna be quiet. But Africa is really a state of mind and a state of consciousness. You don't really have to go there. Of course, yes, you should go. No doubt, go anywhere in the world you want to travel. But you first of all have to have a mindset to understand that you are a part of this great continent that's got over 50 countries, and that the United States can fit into about four times. I was talking to a sister a few days ago, and she mentioned the country of Africa. I said, what do you mean the country of Africa? I said, Africa is, she was talking about some students who were going to UNC, and she was saying that the students were from the country of Africa. I said, what country? I said, Africa has 50 countries. So she was thinking, as most people do, as Malcolm said, that you played last week, that Africa was not a continent, but Africa was one small country.
Right.
But I had to make it clear to her that Africa is a continent, about 50 countries in housed in that continent, and the United States could fit into that continent about four times. But it's been made small in our minds because we can feel we have a feeling of powerlessness if we don't see how great our land and our home place is.
You know, you mentioned Du Bois, and I just wanted to add to that. I was doing some research, and actually, Du Bois's influence into looking at Africa in a much more keen and critical way was the work of Leo Hansberry.
That's right. And Leo Hansberry, by the way, he was at that Negro school up in Washington, D.C. He was on faculty at Howard University.
But
the
he
same,
was
same school
Africa.
That fired Carl G. Woodson from the history department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they studied Africa. And Du Bois liked
that's
him.
Right.
Du Bois used to always call him to study.
Leo Hansberry, and what was his fellow scholars named Leo Hansberry and Joseph Harris.
Joseph Harris. But he was later, though. He was much younger than all of them. But it was Hansberry that was working. Well, first of all, Hansberry was influenced by Du Bois based on what he was, but Du Bois was also influenced by him based on his knowledge of Africa. And that's how he got in there.
So the two-way street, it was two-way street there, right?
That's right, it sure was. Real quickly, and then I'm going to open up the lines and let some of our guests kind of give their thoughts on this whole subject. I want you to just kind of mention briefly for us, and by the way, to our listening audience, I'm talking with Dr. Bruce Bridges, who is the author of a book called Recapturing the African Mind. He is a college professor. He currently teaches at the Apex School of Theology. He has written extensively about the Pan-African experience and Africans, and so that's why I asked him to come on today and just join in on the conversation. We really appreciate him. And he's been in the Black Reality Think Tank many times before, so he's on.
And since you Right, and since you mentioned too, Bill, before I forget it, you mentioned my book, Recapturing the After Mine.
Right.
And you also mentioned earlier how the slave trade was abolished by the British in about 1807.
Right.
But interestingly enough, in my book, Recapturing the African Mind, I have a chapter called The Humanitarian Movement. Now, what the British did after they abolished the slave trade, they sat down and called a meeting of some of the parliament people and some of the people in high positions, people like Thomas Buxton and people like William Wilberforce and people like that. And they called a meeting to abolish the slave trade, which they did. But at that same meeting where they abolished the slave trade, they also wanted to push the whole idea of Africans accepting the religion of Christianity, tying back in what you said about
right.
the missionary. They took the slave, they took the chains off of the wrists and the ankles of Africans to an extent, like you said, and you're right about that. There was still some slave trading going on. But for the most part, on paper, they abolished the slave trade, but at the same time they were abolishing the slave trade, they had a movement called the humanitarian movement
right.
to push Africans into accepting Christianity and becoming Christians, because they knew and understood that if we accepted Christianity, then we would not have to have chains on our ankles and on our wrists, because our minds would be chained, and so therefore they could really control us better, because they wouldn't be, as Willis theory
said, exactly
Willis
right.
Let us say, we wouldn't be destroying our property. Just give them Christianity and give them the Bible, and you can't control them. And just one other thing, I saw this very clearly when I was in Zimbabwe also. I was downtown, and I went to a bookstore downtown in Harare, the capital city of Zimbabwe. And when I went into that bookstore, I saw a Bible, and I picked the Bible up. The white lady was running the bookstore, and I couldn't read the Bible. I said, "What language is this?" She said, "That's Ndebele." So they have translated that Bible into Ndebele in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But when you study the history of the Bible, you find that it's been translated into more languages than any other book on this
right.
planet. And there's a reason for that, because they know that they're going to conquer and colonize a people. Then they can mm-hmm. get to them through their spirituality and through their belief in God and religion. And then they're under control. So they may have taken the chains off of us physically, but they place the chains on us again mentally.
That's true. That's exactly right. And they use their money, too, to do that. A lot of that. They do that.
Oh,
money.
No doubt.
Use their money. Okay. Let me ask you this question right quick before we go, because I'm going to come back to you. But I need to take a break in a minute. Before we go to break, would you kind of just give us your take on why Frederick Douglass was so opposed to Africa?
That's a good question. I thought about it when you were talking about it before. But you're going to take a break? You want me to answer
that? Yeah,
now?
Just kind of briefly deal with it, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
Open up the
okay.
lines.
I think, Bill, it has something to do with his mixed heritage. You know, his father was supposed to have been a white man, in the same way that a lot of the abolitionists, such as, let me just think for a minute, such as George White from North Carolina,
okay.
PBS Pinchback from down in Louisiana, who became a governor briefly,
right.
and people like Blanche K. Bruce. All of these men had some connections with white people, and for the most part, they were not for the Pan-African movement. They were not for blacks going back to Africa. They were for the abolishment of slavery and, of course, us having rights in this country, but somehow they never could step away from the whole idea of them being mulattoes or being light-skinned people or being the offspring of somebody white. And I just mentioned a few: Blanche K. Bruce, George White from North Carolina, and PBS Pinchback, and I can also add into the same discussion Booker T. Washington. For the most part, they may have wanted to have some good connections or relationships with Africa, but for the most part, if you find these people of mixed race, I'm sounding like Garvin now, of mixed race, they tend not to want to go back to Africa.
Okay.
To stay, not okay. to stay.
All right. We are talking a relationship to Africa. The topic of our program today was, is Africa calling you home? And we are talking with Dr. Bruce Bridges.
Good topic.
Thank you. Who is the author of Recapturing the Apple Mind, and we're going to come back and we're going to open up the lines and let some of you give your position on this. So we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Kose segalele Africa, malupala Yesu tumolayo, yezwa yemitana so yechu.
Kose
segalele,
segalele,
tina,
tina,
lusapolayo. Kose segalele Africa,
tina,
malupala Yesu
ponolwayo,
yezwa imithandazo yethu. Kose,
kose
segalele,
segalele,
tina, lusapolayo. Morena buluga si chama sa Yesu, ufedise dintwali maswenyeho. Morena buluga si chama sa Yesu, ufedise dintwali maswenyeho.
Kuse buluge,
kuse buluge,
kuse buluge morena.
Kuse buluge si chama sa Yesu, se chama sa Africa. Mago benjalo, mago benjalo, kuse kubengu na pagate, kuse kubengu na pagate.
Good evening. You are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank, and I am your host, William Rogers. As you know, we are here every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. to 10. And we are here on the timeforawakening.com, blacktalkradio.com network. There are other programs also on this system that are very crucial and very important for many of you that might be interested. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, there's a program called African Perspectives, and it broadcasts at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. African Perspectives, and is hosted by my very good friend and brother, Osiemi Adelabu. Also, on Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Acres of Diamonds. Acres of Diamonds, every Monday from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And then on Monday from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., we have Let's Buy Black 365. Let's Buy Black 365. Every Monday, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And then, as you know, on Tuesday, it's the Black Reality Think Tank at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Wednesday from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., we have Revise, Revise, hosted by POC, which stands for Proof of Consciousness. Revive, every Wednesday evening from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., host by Proof of Consciousness. And then on Friday, from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m., we have Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Dynamic program, dynamic discussion, Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, Fridays at 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Saturday, SST, Saturday Sports Talk, hosted by Troy Wilmore. Troy Wilmore, on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon, Eastern Time, Sports Talk. And then Revive, again, hosted by POC, Proof of Conscience, on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Sunday evening, to close out the week schedule, Time for an Awakening, hosts Brother Elliot and Brother Richard again from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. And that is the lineup of programs operating on the timeforanawakening.com. There are some new ones on the way, some very exciting ones, and I'm really looking forward to hearing those. I won't mention them yet, but we will be announcing those very soon. So let's go to our lines and see what our guest has to say. My good brother from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 267-333. Good afternoon, caller.
Dr. Rogers.
Yes, sir.
Another home run hitter. You have all these great scholars coming on, man, to give us all this information.
Thank you, my
brother. And Dr. Bridges, it is a pleasure, sir.
Thank you. Dr. Bridges, are you still there? Oh, hold it just a second. I heard some noise in his background. I had to mute his telephone.
Okay.
Dr. Bridges, you still there?
Yes, sir. You hear me now?
Yeah, he was he was congratulating you.
Yes, that's the Muslim brother I think I heard on your program this past Saturday. I recognize his voice. Yeah. He's from Philadelphia. I don't know if from West Philly, North Philly, Germantown, or just the way
let
it might be.
You, sir, I grew up in South Philadelphia and West Philadelphia, and I'm back and forth because my mom and her sister's in West Philly, and I'm in South Philly with my cousin, so I'm back and forth and back and forth. And
well, I'm speaking to you from Durham, North Carolina. I used to go to Philadelphia quite a bit. Used to go to the Temple of Jeremiah Shabazz up there. Well, Malcolm started the temple first. Since we're talking about Malcolm, Malcolm actually started the temple, as you well know, in Philadelphia before Jeremiah Shabazz.
Let me tell you something, man. Jeremiah, I was with Jeremiah during his last days. A gentleman by the name of Suleiman, who he used to hang with, during his last days, I seen Jeremiah, and he still had all that fire. Mm-hmm. And that was approximately, I would say, in the 80s. And 19, I believe, 98 or 99, my mom had to read her dissertation for a PhD in Europe. And that day that we had to leave for Europe is the day of his funeral. Mm. I was hurt. The day that he was buried, I had to leave to go with my mom
to
read a dissertation. Yep, to her dissertation.
Right. Yeah, what country in Europe did you go to?
My mom read a dissertation in Switzerland. It was at a creative teaching conference. And I guess because like they said, like father like son, sometimes like son like mother, because the reason why I'm educated, because she's an educator.
Right.
She's retired now, but and let me tell you something, man. Jeremiah's influence on Philadelphia, because Jeremiah had Philadelphia, top of clock, temple number 12, and Malcolm had temple number 7. He was in Philadelphia first. He was in Boston for a while.
That's right.
He did go to New York. And listen, Jeremiah, there's a book that Jeremiah, have you ever read Jeremiah's book?
I want to get the one that the brother put out. I've been trying to get it. We'll talk about it later. We don't take Brother Bill Rogers with this. But I want you to get my phone number from Dr. Rogers, or have him to give me yours. And I'll call you later on tonight. So we'll talk about it later.
One thing I do want to tell you about those ministers that were in the Nation of Islam, Jeremiah Shabazz walked into a Ku Klux Klan rally. And when he walked into the Ku Klux Klan, they wanted to talk to him because Jeremiah said that when I walked in there, he said, "We like you. We like your philosophy." And he said, I like you. I want to meet your leader." He said, "My leader's name is Elijah Muhammad." And they said, Jeremiah came out and he talked to him. And after that, they let him out of the Ku Klux Klan meeting. And they said, "When you met up with Elijah Muhammad, Elijah said, you actually did that?" Hmm. He said, "The reason why I actually did it," he said, "because you put that much strength in me to go amongst them like that." But Jeremiah was a great man. That's another story for another time.
Okay.
Right. Sam Christian and Ron Harvey, all that. Another story. We can talk. We can talk later.
Man,
any comments on the African? My brother.
His brother-in-law, who's the one that told me Islam very early as a teenager. But we'll talk about it another time. But listen,
any comments that you wanted to make on the African discussion?
Yes, sir. I want to say it right now. I talked about going to school with Malcolm's daughter, and I also talked about Gil Noble's son, and I also talked about Dick Gregory's daughter was deep with me from class of 83. But listen, I am 35 years out of Lincoln University, and I graduated from 1983. And guess what our quote is? From Nkrumah. Those who will judge us merely by the heights we have achieved would do well to remember the depths from which we started. Kwame Nkrumah, 1930.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to say this to you, that Nkrumah and Ezekiel were Lincoln graduates. And anytime,
good point.
That's right. Anytime somebody talks about them, I always tell them that Nkrumah got a lot of his knowledge when he came to America. When he learned from Marcus Garvey that the way he was uniting people in America, that when he went back to Africa, he said Africa must unite. So his influence of being over here in America and watching what was going on, especially with Marcus Garvey, his influence was widely spread. Marcus Garvey, people don't realize the influence. If you ever read some of Adam Clayton Powell's works, he has a book called a marching soldier, something like that. He talks about very young how Marcus Garvey would walk through the streets. And while he was young, while his father was the Baptist minister in that large church. And he also said that Marcus Garvey's sense of pride, people never understood what he was doing. They understood Marcus Garvey much later. Let's talk about the African experience.
Okay.
I was in graduate school, and in graduate school, one of my favorite books that I read was Aquiano. And in reading Aquiano, I was very surprised because in the beginning of Aquiano's voyage, I think the first slaves that they were brought over here were able to roam the ships. Now, in roaming the ships, in other words, I don't think they were trained at first. And when you talk about the brainwashing of being in America and not wanting to go back to the continent or having any connection with it, my question to you is that he comes over to America, okay? He learns to speak English. They set him up like he's royalty. And you know, that was odd to me, and he never wanted to go back. My thing is that the brainwashing of Aquiano, I question that he wants to be a part of this system. And I thought about what you said about Douglas and Du Bois very early in their life.
Right,
that
exactly.
I don't believe Aquiano was mixed with anything, but the brainwashing started early with him. He probably accepted Christianity and all the things that went along with it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but my thing was is that you also said something about a person, Leo Hansberry. That was also Lorraine Hansberry's uncle, wasn't it?
What was? Lorraine? Yeah, that's right. Lorraine Hansberry.
That was her uncle.
Leo Hansberry was her uncle. That's right.
I did not know that Dr. Leo Hansberry influenced Dr. Du Bois like
oh,
that.
Oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, yes, indeed. Very much so. But again, now, Leo Hansberry was younger. But he was actually gravitating to Du Bois because, you know, he was wanting to influence him. But once Du Bois found out his work and what he was doing and how extensive it was, Du Bois began to use him. And he invited him to some very powerful conferences to speak on some of his research. So, yeah, that's very, very clear. Very, very clear.
Well, his niece must have been influenced, too, because she wrote Young, Gifted, and Black.
Yeah, sure did. Yeah, yeah,
well, she also wrote Raising the Sun, didn't she?
Exactly. Well, listen, I got a bunch of folk on here waiting.
I want to get back to this, and I want to talk about the experience. I like what you said about what our ancestors had did or the people in the past had did, but these people I've been around in my younger life and me at my age right now, I don't know if you I know you've heard of Dr. Clark and Dr. Ben. There's a guy by the name of Kwesi, and he does a trip from America to Nile Valley, and it's like $3,700, and you're there a whole week, and he gives you a tour of Nile Valley. He takes you to the Nile River. He takes you to the Tomb of Abydos. He takes you to the places where I have read about and taught about in my history class.
Right.
Who have never been. And I'm trying to plan that trip because, like, my mind is in love with Africa. I can see myself opening my mind more, like Dr. Rogers, you talking about we should visit the plantations, we should see some of the things, that the horrific places, the museums,
right,
and things of that nature, to actually know how we were treated once we got here, how we were reduced once we got here, and what we became as a result of being here.
Right.
So I'm willing to take all those trips, but I'm also listening to what you're saying about these people who are giving us so much information. I have to add it to my archives. I really do. But all I enjoy the show because it opens me up, man. If you think
that's
you know a lot,
that's good.
People need to call this. They really need to call here.
Okay. All right. Thank you, my brother. Okay. Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Yes, doctor.
Yes. Hi. How you doing there, my brother? How you doing? Let me open, brother Bruce here. Dr. Bridges, I had muted you because you had some real strong sound in the background, so I had to mute that for a minute. Okay, Dr. Bridges?
I'm here. You might want to mute me again, too. Let Brother Pugh go ahead on because I'm driving, but I want to be a part of the program.
I just listened.
Okay. Mute me again.
Okay. Okay.
Well, actually, I'm more in a listening mode. I'm, you know, really have very little of depth that, you know, that I can contribute. So okay. I'd rather listen. So.
All right. Beautiful. Thank you. Always love your remarks. So, okay. Thank you. Newport News, Virginia. Caller, good afternoon. How are you today?
How you doing, Dr. Rogers? I'm in a listening mode, but I wanted to ask you, how does all that relate to today, contemporary? Because I'm somewhat of a student of the past, and I'm really enjoyed what I've been hearing tonight. I'm taking notes so I can go back and read a little bit more in depth. But I also know that the continent of Africa is nothing like it was during the time period you're talking about, because I've been keeping track of the last 20 years, and you got AFRICOM, the U.S. government, in 53 out of 54 African countries. That's a fact.
That's
look
right.
It up. And Obama was the one that actually expanded it that far, with Stuttgart, Germany.
Exactly.
But the other part is people that were instrumental, I'm talking black people, that were instrumental in the Clinton administration when he was the secretary, are now running investment companies that are saying, their opening words are, to work with us because we have the continent open wide for investment.
Right.
That's Black Ivy Group, Cheryl Mills, the lady who ran Hillary Clinton's office. So what Africa are you talking about when you talk about going back to Africa?
Right.
The richest Nigerians there are billionaires, and you got 80 million people living in abject poverty. So I just want to know, what continent are you talking about?
Exactly. That's a good question. Okay, let me kind of give you an idea of what the basis of the discussion is that I wanted us to do to bring out the points that would be necessary, just like what you said, to be necessary to look at going back to Africa. What is it that you would have to first understand about that? Because as it's being proposed, and in some cases, I don't hear that plan of action. But obviously, very clearly, it would have to be looked at from today's standpoint. And I like the work that Randall Robertson had attempted to try to do with his Trans-Africa movement. And when you go in and look at some of the work that the Trans-Africa movement was doing, they were trying to look at what are the possibilities of obviously negotiating and working with some of the leadership of Africa at that time. How would you be able to do that? And it was difficult, you know, as you know. And now it has even changed more because you've got some other factors that are involved now. You got these religious wars that are going on there that we can't rule out what happened in the Biafran situation. You get to remember how that ugly, ugly history. And this was among Africans with Africans. So can you imagine a group of us coming over and setting up a space somewhere in a continent and dealing with the country? So to answer your question, it's a think tank question. It's a think tank consideration. How do you plan for something like this? And the question, obviously, the ultimate question, is it even possible in today's time? So that's kind of where I have going, and that's why I wanted to talk about it in this way. And obviously, I can't do it in the 2 hours. You know, it's not enough time to go through that. But at least let's bring out some of the stuff. And then obviously, looking at that history, it would show you that a lot of the things that happened in that historical context would still happen again today, possibly. You know, can you imagine relocating into an area where these Islamic wars could possibly inflict some things, you know, like what happened with Boko Haram and the Janjaweed out of the Sudan and all of that? So, you know, again, a thought process of doing that. So that's why I wanted for us to look at that today. Anything you want to add to that, Dr. Bridges? Okay. All right.
I would just like to say that the mentality has certainly changed on the continent of Africa as it has changed in America. And this whole idea of Pan-Africanism and Africa for the Africans at home and abroad, you just don't see it now. And it's really depressing sometimes when I speak to some of the brothers and sisters, you know, as I call the continental Africans, because their minds are gone. Europe is almost completely and totally wiped them out. I mean, even when you look at down in Zimbabwe, as you well know, they're talking about giving the land back to the European colonizers, as Mugabe had gotten it back for us in Africa, but now they're talking about giving it back to them again and giving them a long lease, whereas in South Africa, they're talking about taking it without compensation, which is really better. So it's really a very difficult question now, and it's quite depressing. Mentality is just messed up so bad.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Area code 602. Any comments to this discussion? How are you this afternoon?
Hey, good brother. How are you doing?
How you brother doing, Marcus. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, good brother. There is a good book by Walter Rodney called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that book will help us to see how they use tribalism in Africa to, you know, divide up Africa, rule Africa, how they use tribalism. Now, we know in Africa, tribalism is a problem. Religion is a problem. In this part of the world, it's more nationalism, you know, it's a problem. It's more, I'm Jamaican, I'm Haitian, I'm African-American, you know. But we are more... To a sense, we are more detribalized here, in especially in America, because of the way the European treated black people here. It's more we have less tribalism, and that's why the Garvey movement took off here.
Right.
See, in contrast to Jamaica, see, because of the treatment. No, I think that the way forward is for us to pick up where Mr. Garvey left off, as far as those ships. You know, it's if you study his Garvey, is when he got those ships, that's when they really intensify locked them up and deported them out of the country, because with those ships, you know, he could move goods and services and develop trade with Africa, you see? And I think what we have to realize is that some of the leaders in Africa, they don't want to see us come home. It's not the people in Africa is the problem. It's some of the leadership in Africa, because they are flunkies. See, they are the black flunkies that the European rule through them. So I think what we should develop is one or two of us going to Africa won't make a dent, but developing a mass movement moving to Africa, 50,000 strong, you know, 100,000 strong, that will make a dent in Africa.
Right.
You see, and I think that's where we have to go, and we have to not make the mistakes of the past that going there with this mentality and developing a class system, but including them in our program, including the African, intermarrying with them, business, you know, joint venture business relationships, you see, because that is the solution. You know, regardless of who is in Africa, the Chinese, we know the Americans, everybody are there, you know, but, you know, if we look, it could change tomorrow, you know, it could change tomorrow if we if we get to the people. That's all we have to get to, is the people, the mass majority of our people. So let's go back to Africa and not so much petition the governments. Go into Africa, do business with our people, pay the government their taxes, and get ourselves established in Africa, because the people in Africa love us. Right. You know, but the leadership is some of the problem in Africa. See, because they don't want us to come, because they can compete with our brain trust. Because we are, you have to remember, you know, we are technologically ahead of these our people on the continent at least 100 years.
Right.
See, so we have the technology, we have the capital, they have the resources, they have the labor force. And we should intermarry that and develop Africa, so both of us could come up. Because again, Africa is the prize for black people. It's not America. It's Africa where the mass majority of our population lies. You know, so you know, I think that's where we should go. Pick up where Mr. Garvey left off. We sit around the table. Leave your religion at the door. Leave your politics at the door. Mm-hmm. It's racial, economic cooperation. It's Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. Those who don't want to go back to Africa, you could be our eyes and ears here in America.
Right.
And we will be in Africa. We'll be your eyes and ears in Africa. And we trade together.
Right.
We can do it. We must do it. Because our survival relies on it, and I'll mute my phone and continue listening. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you, my brother. Thank you, Brother Marcus.
All right.
Excellent statement. I just got a text from Brother Griffin, who has indicated that the African-American woman who was running for governor for Georgia has just won the Democratic nomination, so that's an interesting development. And that whole race has been a very interesting race, very biased in a lot of ways. I don't have a lot of time to talk about it right now, but there were some ugly things were done in these elections, even on the Republican side, the conservative side, and what the conservatives were pushing, the agenda that they were pushing. But anyway, she was successful. Let's go. I have a 919-220. You may not want to say anything. I'm not sure. But your mic is open if you do want to say something. Or 919-220. Okay. All right. Move on to 414-324. 414.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Hello, Brother Oshie. How are you doing? I know you got something to say about this.
Well, you know. That's what I am. I'm a Pan-Africanist.
I know it.
You know?
That's good. That's good.
In fact, I'm going to the Pan-African Plenary Conference in D.C. this weekend, the Pan-African Federalist Movement.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I'm going there this weekend to hear what is being stated and what are the plans to establish, you know, Pan-Africanism. And there's a conference being planned for next year in Ghana.
Okay.
Of course, because next year, of course, would be 400 years that we would have been under this system. Mm. And the question I think we need to ask ourselves is, what is our next move? You know, because we've done all the begging, pleading, wishing, hoping, praying, marching, sitting in, you name it, we've done it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And collectively, our situation has worsened. So I'm not, you know, concerned about what percentage of us who are doing well, who are always pushing politics, always pushing voting, and all of that kind of stuff. But I think it's still conversation for us. Just as Brother Marcus said, you know, and just as Marcus Garvey said, you may not accept my plan now, you may accept my plan 100 years from now. And that's where we are. We must be talking about sovereignty for African people, because there really is no other discussion for us but sovereignty for African people, controlling who we are mentally, mostly, physically, spiritually, and controlling what's under the feet of African people: resources, land. So I think that you know, if that's not what the discussion is,
no, that's
I'm going to be awfully disappointed.
I understand. Yeah, that's good. That's exactly right. And I think that's what Brother Griffin was asking. What are we? What are you talking about? How? And I think that's a question that a lot of folks have. How does this proceed? And as I indicated, my discussion tonight was to bring it to in a think tank like format. Let's think this thing out. How do you do it? We know we need to do it. We know that. But again, it's just more than a notion. It has to
right.
be thought out very carefully. And that's kind of what
right.
we wanted to do. So right. Thank you, Brother Oshie. I know you'll be on tomorrow. At 11 a.m. Eastern time. So
right.
We look forward to your program tomorrow. Thank you so much.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Dr. Rogers.
Okay.
I'll continue to listen.
Area code 336-621.
Greetings, Alafia. How are your brothers doing and everybody else?
Oh, greetings, my sister. Greetings. Always good. That's a... Let me turn Brother Boosie with some noise in his background, so I had to have the noise to turn him on. Yeah, but how are you doing today?
Okay. Brother Bruce, how are you doing? I know he's got
I'm
it
all right,
on
sister. I'm all right, sister, but this is how I turn it off, so I'm back now. Yeah, I'm the good. Peace. Hotep.
It's good to hear the family. Good to hear the family talking about this critical issue.
Okay.
2 points I want to make. You know, Brother Malcolm said, talked about in the beginning piece that you played about us not feeding into them, pitting us against each other.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a critical step that we have to take because, Doc, you said, you know, how do we do it? How do we do this? The first thing we got to do is do what other people do. We have to see ourselves as a we again. We don't see ourselves as a we. When I was listening to the brother, I think his name is Brother Marcus.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you, Brother Marcus. When I lived in Brooklyn, I was raised in Brooklyn, and I remember how the West Indians and the black folk born in America and the Africans and, you know, everybody was pitted against each other.
Right.
And when I was younger, I really didn't understand why we would call Trinidadians and Haitians and whatnot in Brooklyn all these names, and then they would call us Yankees and other names. And I didn't understand what the conflict was about.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I understand that this was engineered by the European, you know, to keep us pitted against each other so we would unite and have the strength that we need. So the first thing we need to do is work on that piece. It can be done.
Right.
Just having the conversations, you know, across the nation and then, of course, across the diaspora about who pitted us against each other, because that's not all of who we are. Our nature is not all tribalism. But deep down inside, we understand that we are one people. And so that there has to be intent. You know, we have to intentionally do that piece.
Right.
Because it is that division is destroying us. Even when I moved south, you know, I was a Yankee, and I used to call Southerners bumpkins and whatnot. And then when I, you know, start to increase my consciousness, again, I said, why is this happening?
Mm-hmm.
So we need to deal with that, because that relates to Bruce's book on reclaiming the African mind.
Right. Exactly.
We have to have our minds back
exactly.
and intact in order to do anything. So that's a very critical piece.
Thank
and
you.
The other thing I want to mention is that I'm reading a book, and in the book there's a letter that was written to the government by some slaves that had just been recently released from the plantation with nothing, zero, nowhere to go, no food, no money, no nothing. And after suffering so badly, they wrote a letter to someone in the government, not quite sure who they were writing to, but the letter says, we the colored people of Montgomery County are in a bad fix. We have no rights in the county. We want to know if there's any way for us to get out of the country and go someplace where we can get homes. So please, will you let us know if we can go to Africa? If any emigrants to Africa for the black man, please let us know. We want to go so bad. There is a plea from this person, and it says that there's desperation, there's anxiety, there's panic, for the Negro is being burned, shot, hanged, unjointed, and murdered in every way. Our civil rights are taken from us by force. Our political rights are a farce. Now, I read this letter recently.
Mm-hmm.
After one of the shootings of the young black males last year, a young sister wrote a very similar letter. And I was blown away. The same letter that was written in 1870-something was written by a sister in 2016. Mm-hmm. The same way we were being murdered and tortured back then is still happening. And I doubt if the sister that wrote the letter, I saw it online, knows about our history.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right.
So, okay. So we have to find a way to come back together. We can do it. We have the ancestors on our side. We are spiritual people. We got to look at this thing differently. And one last thing that's very important. There's a younger breed, a younger African that is coming to revolutionary mindset. And I'm meeting them. It's like the ancestors are sending me these people, and they are ready for revolution. They're from the motherland, and they're here, but they know what's going on. They're learning their history because they've never learned it, and they're shocked, and they are angry. So there are plenty of people from the motherland that do want to unite with the African-born Africans here and that are conscious, but they're not going to just blurt it out and get on shows and whatnot because they're concerned about other things, as you would understand. But they are here. They are awake. And I believe if we make a strong effort, then we will do something because we better do something. We have no choice.
Right, exactly. While I have you on the phone, Sister Ayan, Brother Adelabu wants me to give you his number or you give him yours. I just want to let you know, Brother Oshie, I'm going to do that. I told you I was planning on doing that. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Go right
thank
in.
Thank you, Doc.
Yeah, and he wants to get to talk with you about his program. Which is called African Perspective as well. And so I'm going to pass that on to him, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. It's about unity.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right. I've got a call. Before I do, Brother Griffin, when you get an opportunity, I need you to send me your number as well, too, if you don't mind. If you don't mind texting it on the board there, I want to call you as well, Brother Griffin. So if you could just tag your number over in that comment section, that would be great. I appreciate it. Okay, area code 502-727. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. This is Sister Susani, originally from Botswana, D.C. in Kentucky, and I wanted to add a few points to the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I still consider myself a continental African. Although next year I'll be completing my 30th year of living in the U.S. And I'll tell you the most beautiful thing, it's been a painful experience, obviously, being African, being a Black person in America, as we all experience the trauma. But the best thing that's come out of it for me, and I think for a lot of other continental Africans, somebody else had mentioned the Kwame Nkrumah, it is the knowledge that we'll go obtain regarding ourselves, who we are as Africans globally. But I just wanted to touch on what one brother had mentioned about the leadership. You know, we talk about the leadership in Africa, but
okay.
I don't understand why we do not see it as the same thing as the leadership we have in the USA, the NAACP, and all these other people who are always getting voted in and never, ever do anything for our people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as the leadership in Africa. You know, just a little bit of a different twist to it, but it's the same thing. It's all leading to the death of our people, physically and mentally.
Right.
And so I don't understand why we still even praise those who are winning in these elections. I don't know why we still even talk about voting for anybody, whether it's in the U.S., the Caribbean, or Africa, wherever Africans are. This system is not meant for us. It's there to kill us. And those people who are being highlighted in the media, you know, the wars and all that's going on in Africa, I mean, you'll be shocked where I come from in Botswana. Every time I go there, they say, how can you be living in America all these years? It's such a violent country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the beginning, I used to get shocked because I had never thought of America as a violent country. But we hear about violence all the time. But those who get highlighted in the media, this Jewish evil media, are getting highlighted for a reason. It's because they're going to perpetuate the same information that the system, the evil system that's not working for us, is set up. But there is the sister who came, I don't know who the sister is, but there's a lot of activity going on the continent you know, people are excited. There's a lot of activity going on here in the U.S. We are all excited about making sure we keep those bonds, you know, from between the continental Africans and those in the diaspora. And this is that's the solution that we need to do. And I you know, I want to remind everybody that there are countries in Africa that are even advocating for dual citizenship now. And I feel every African, wherever they are, by any means necessary, should gain citizenship of some of these countries on the continent, because this is our survival now. And we have got to regain Africa in order to make it, because we're being attacked, you know, we're being attacked all the time. You know, in the U.S., it's what, next year is going to be 400 years. This system has not helped us at all. The voting and marching and writing letters every time the NAACP doesn't do what it, you know, doesn't talk against the Palestinian or whoever. They don't even talk about Africans. You know, they're not going to say anything about Palestinians being slaughtered in Palestine.
Okay.
You know, so I just wanted to add that, because I think you know, the people we hear about are not going to be the people who care about African people. I had to work very hard to even find time for an awakening, because I had to find my, you know, what I considered my people, my African people who were conscious, knew what was going on. But it took a long time, because everything you see in the media is going to be people who are promoting the system that works against us. So I just wanted to say that
we can do it.
Uh-huh. Knowledge of self is what we need, and knowledge of the enemy. And those who support the enemy, the people amongst us, I think, including our family members, I think this is where the challenge is. And I would want to end by quoting Dr. Obadile Cambon, because he's one of the people I'm following, because he repatriated and has been there for a while. He's a young person. The key to it, all of us are going to look at ourselves, have to look, start with us, and re-Africanize and de-whitenize, because it's very easy for all of us to point at the leaders and whoever is not doing the work. And yet we can step out of this, you know, our own homes, abodes, and people cannot tell the difference between us and a European.
Okay.
You know, we can talk all the good talk, but if we're not even doing anything in our personal lives to really be African,
you got to put the action.
I don't think we're getting anywhere.
Right.
So I just wanted to touch that. Thank you very much, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you so much. Dr. Bridges,
I'll,
you want to
meet myself and listen.
Dr. Bridges, you want to respond to some of the things she said?
I agree with her 100% in what she said, Dr. Rogers. That's about all I can say. I'm looking at the time, but I don't want to, you know, go too far.
Right.
I agree with her 100%.
Right, we are at that time. Well, you know, this is an ongoing conversation. It's something that we obviously cannot complete in one sitting, but it is the process in which the conversation must continue. The realities of it, the fact we know this, one conclusion that it seems to be clear among everybody that has spoken today is that it needs to be done. And I think that very clearly, once we understand that and understand why we need to do that, and that's clear, you know, then you have a goal. Now the next thing is, how do we make it happen? And that's you have to discuss. And one of the things that I would definitely like to add to that would be a part of another discussion is you're going to have to do some coalition building. And it's going to have to not only just be in Africa, it's going to have to be in other parishes as well. And that's what a lot of our scholars had. You know, we've talked a lot about the relationship, for instance, that Marcus Garvey had with some of the folk. It wasn't just people in Africa. Ho Chi Minh and the whole incident with him and his relationship. Ho Chi Minh sought out Garvey because he liked his ideas. He liked his plan. And even the Mao Zedong was very interested in some of the African revolutionary ideas that were coming out of America. And we're embracing of that, and there's literature available to talk about that. And so we're going to have to coalition build. We didn't take advantage of some of the key individuals that we could have worked with, people like Cesar Chavez. We didn't work with him. The brother out of Venezuela that died, we could have used some of that energy. He was willing to reach out, do some things. You know, and everybody has their political agenda, we know, but still. Those are opportunities of coalition building that we could really look at. Well, we've come to the time, the end. I really would like to thank all of our callers, our listening audience, those of you who have consistently support. We'll be back next Tuesday night, 8 p.m., here on the Black Reality Think Tank. I thank all of you for supporting and calling us, and we will see you on next Tuesday. Thank and have a very productive week.
Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me.